Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry.
Todd Rapp got his career started in equity options at Goldman Sachs in the late 1990s, a wild time in which a bubble inflated and burst and provided critical lessons in both gamma and vega risk in the process. Now the CEO of the Fortress Multi-Manager Group, Todd leans heavily on his derivatives DNA in the areas of sourcing uncorrelated return streams, portfolio construction, and both measuring and managing risk. Early training has shaped his long-term view that markets express probability through delta, option curvature, and distribution structure rather than through static price movements. Our conversation connects early risk management lessons to today's landscape, where market concentration echoes 1999, yet correlation conditions differ meaningfully. Todd notes that unlike the prior cycle, today's equity index shows low intra-index correlation, making dispersion, risk sizing, and factor neutrality more fundamental for return generation. We also explore how the multi-manager architecture seeks to harness uncorrelated strategies packaged with capital efficiency and leverage, producing return streams engineered to operate through dispersion. Todd highlights how understanding optionality remains central to managing equity factor shocks, beta instability, and correlation convergence events. Lastly, we touch on the human capital side of building a business. Having interviewed hundreds of risk takers over the years, Todd looks for individuals who have something to prove, suggesting that having experienced adversity is important because, quote, if you don't have a significant drawdown in your past, it's coming in your future. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Todd Rapp. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Todd Rapp. He is the CEO of the Multi-Manager Group at Fortress, a platform seeking to deliver uncorrelated returns in all market environments. Todd, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Dean. Appreciate it. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
As am I. Our podcast is very focused on risk management with heavy overlay of derivatives. And so often we geek out a little bit on vol and correlation and words like convexity. So we'll do a little bit of that. But really what we're going to focus on is the business of running a multi-manager platform. And so let's first just get into your career background a little bit. You did get your start in derivatives, which I'm sure you lean into a lot in your current role. Take us a little bit through the career trajectory for you.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. And doing this a long time now, you get a live look here, not to interject, but you get a live look behind me at all the growth that we're seeing in Dallas. I'm based in Dallas, Texas now at Fortress. Great place to be. And it's really a spot that's exploding in our business. I've been doing this, I guess, now north of 25 years. As you mentioned, I started my career as a vol trader at Goldman Sachs. I went through the analyst and associate program starting back in 1999, which I think was really an interesting time to start in this business, particularly in the derivative space. And there certainly were some corollaries to where we are today. I mean, if everyone probably recalls, 1999 was the internet frenzy where you had a lot of low quality and anything that had its name attached to the internet stocks was exploding higher. I got started there. It was a great place to learn. I was a single stock volatility trader. After Goldman Sachs went through the analyst and associate program, I left to go to the buy side. And I've now spent north of 20 years buy side in the hedge fund business. That's predominantly been in really mostly risk management and portfolio management roles. I spent about 10 years at a firm called Karsh Capital, which was a long short equity fund based in New York, working for Michael Karsh. I left there to become the first chief risk officer at a firm called Highfields Capital, which was Boston based and run by a guy named John Jacobson, who certainly is a legendary value investor. And then after Highfields, really got what became my start in the multi-strat, multi-manager world by being part of the group that went out and launched Folger Hill, which was really aiming to be a multi-strat, multi-manager business that used the employee model to go build and compete with the big multi-strat, multi-manager businesses. And so for a few years, we'll dive into that. I mean, it was a great opportunity for me to really learn about the business. And then after Folger Hill, really started working on building what we have today and what has become really the Fortress Multi-Manager Group. And so this is something that I've spent the last, really since late 2021 working on. We were acquired by Fortress back at the end of 2023. Fortress Investment Group, as many folks know, has been around for a long time, really north of 25 years at this point, and has really been a great place for us. I mean, Fortress has expertise in the credit space. And in 2023, really closing in 2024, the management team of Fortress and Mubadala teamed up to buy the business from SoftBank. And so Fortress, really in the last year and a half or so, has really started a growth trajectory and has a willingness to do new things. And so our business has become part of Fortress, and it's been really an exceptional place for us to have support and to build and grow our business.
It's going to give us a ton to talk about. Let's go all the way back to 1999. So boy, getting into a seat in single stock vol trading circa 1999 is a pretty interesting start, maybe rivaled by if you started in early 2007 in terms of the amount of change that was coming your way. So what were you trading? What was your pet?
So when I started there, I was the junior guy on, at the time, it was internet, hardware, and financials. What's funny about 1999 is that financials was sort of throwaway. There wasn't a lot happening in financials. It was low vol space. And so they added it to that broader internet and hardware book. What was really interesting is a funny corollary to me being in Dallas now is one of the things that we worked on back at that time was, if you recall, Mark Cuban, who's obviously a big, well-known guy, particularly from Dallas and the Dallas area. Mark Cuban had actually sold broadcast.com to Yahoo. And he had a whole bunch of Yahoo stock and had put on prepaid variable share forward, which is effectively a collar and a loan on his Yahoo stock. And this was 99. And so one of the things that I worked on, one of the first things that I was doing at Goldman Sachs was actually spending time managing the gamma and the delta of that position. Goldman had the other side of that position. And so there was a proxy basket of a whole bunch of different internet stocks that we were using to hedge. It's just really interesting because now, as I sit here in Dallas, I mean, the reason Mark Cuban is, I'd imagine part of the reason why he still is incredibly wealthy guy is because he actually collared Yahoo stock back in 1999. And so it's pretty interesting. But as I said, it was a really exciting time to be in that world, particularly at Goldman with the amount of IPOs they were having. We were both facilitating institutional flow. So all the hedge funds that would come in and wanted to trade listed options, we would obviously facilitate all that flow. And then we also would manage the portfolio for not only all the high net worth folks who were collaring their previously IPO'd shares, but also a lot of the corporate stuff. So, you know, big tech companies that would do buyback programs through selling puts and things like that, that was all part of that book. And so I think from a career perspective, I can't say enough good things about having an opportunity to start my career in the volatility space and really getting an opportunity to understand and to learn optionality. And I think it has probably continued to serve me well 25 years later. And what I've learned is that everything is optionality. So whether it's me today running a multi-strat, multi-manager business where you're spending a lot of time with volatility and correlation and convexity, or it's even as a fundamental research analyst, everything is about analyzing risk return and probability analysis and optionality. And I think one of the really interesting corollaries as I went through my career and Karsh Capital after Goldman, which was a deep dive fundamental long short equity shop. And one of the funny things that I learned is, you know, if you think about one of the very, very basic principles that you learn as an option trader, as a vol trader, is something as simple as delta. People talk about delta. The way they explain it initially is that delta basically means three things. Delta is the change in an options price for the change in an underlier. Number two is delta is effectively the hedge ratio that a volatility trader uses to hedge out the directional risk of a stock. And the third one, which becomes really relevant, is that it's the market's prediction for the percentage chance that a stock has of finishing in the money. And so if you have a 25 delta call, it means the market is telling you that there's a 25% chance that at expiration, the stock is going to be at or above that price. So when you think about that, and when you look at delta curve in the options market, it's a log normal distribution where on the left tail, you have way out of the money puts, which are low delta. And on the right tail, you have way out of the money calls, which are also low delta. The market has basically given you effectively an expected outcome of that stock. As a fundamental research analyst, and where it relates so well, is all the deep dive analysis that fundamental research analysts are doing is effectively trying to build their own expected outcome or their own probability distribution. So for me, and one of the things that I learned that is a really interesting exercise for a fundamental research analyst is a lot of that analysis and what you're doing after you do your analysis is trying to figure out and predict, like, where am I different than the market? And what I think a lot of fundamental research analysts don't necessarily appreciate is that there is a place where you can go and look at what the market's prediction is for the probability distribution of a stock. And there's really ways that you can find edge and look for places where you differ from the market. And that ultimately is stock picking. So for me, what I found as it's gone through my career is really just understanding optionality, and whether it's looking at deep dive fundamental analysis or thinking about volatility or just thinking about option pricing. And it could be reverse conversions. It could be dividend swaps. It could be convertible bonds, which are effectively bonds with embedded call options. All of that for me, starting my career in the options market, was really an incredible place to learn. And I think decisions that we all make on a daily basis are ultimately just assessing risk return. So I couldn't say more positive things about a place to start your career and learn.
Yeah, you got a couple of things there. So the first is, as you talk about implied distributions and then mapping that versus a fundamental analyst who perhaps has a different distribution, in all my years of covering accounts, of course, I've covered a lot of folks that are the digit heads that focus on vol, arb, and are very mathy and model driven. And I've also covered a lot of Boston-based accounts that are much more in the John Jacobson category of just being fundamentally oriented. And one thing I would say is that you combine a real rigorous understanding of fundamentals with a view or an understanding of optionality, that's a really powerful tool. And I would say that some of those Boston-based accounts were the hardest because they understood the business dynamics better than the market. The vol trading community was pricing it off realized, let's say, and the fundamental analyst who also understood optionality had a sense of capital structure, a more forward-looking understanding of the business dynamics and what they meant for volatility. So they could be sellers of vol at levels that the street was paying for that it shouldn't have. Very interesting. And then the other one I just wanted to, you've talked about the Mark Cuban collar, such a fascinating trade. You could go back and you can't really find another trade that's set up so well. Rates, the Vega was incredibly high. Of course, when you do a prepaid forward or a collar, you're a seller of vol, selling 5-year vol at 60 or something. We learned, of course, the call skew. The stock up vol up of the late 90s, which we're seeing again now, was very much people paying for incredibly out of the money calls. I think his collar was struck at 230 or something like that, 230% spot. Just a brilliant trade to take the chips off the table.
Well, a couple things on that. Back to John Jacobson, it's a great point in that I think a lot of people probably wouldn't appreciate is John is known as really like a legendary value investor. John started his career as a derivatives guy. And so that I think is a place where a lot of folks in this business, having that as a background and starting off and then combining that with other areas of expertise, I do think really gives you a pretty significant edge. One of the things when I was at Goldman Sachs back in, 2002-ish, when I was on the other side of Highfields, you know, Highfields was one of those firms who was very early and very negative on Enron. And they bought a lot of downside puts on Enron. And a lot of that analysis was them trying to assess the probability distribution and what's the best way for them to implement their fundamental view. So it's something that is incredibly valuable. And it also, there's also ways in the price of an option. It's obviously incorporating a lot of different things, which are rates and dividends and the cost to borrow. So there's a lot of thoughtful ways you can implement ideas in that space. And then on the Mark Cuban piece, and back then, like you said, I think some of the setup today is really similar. I mean, if you go back to 1999, the optimism and the view of what the societal change was going to be of the internet, it was obviously correct, but stocks didn't move in a straight line. And so where we are today, you see a lot of those same corollaries where back then it was anything that you said was B2B or tied it to internet, people were buying for a period of time. And so there's obviously a lot of corollaries to that today with AI, and a lot of things that you attach the term AI to are getting bid up. And ultimately that probably is correct in that it is that big of a societal change, maybe even bigger, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that stocks are going to go in a straight line. And so there could be a lot of similarities to it, we'll see, but where you can both be long-term right, but it can be pretty painful getting there along the way. So it's a pretty interesting time.
I think when you and I last spoke, we were talking about the incredibly low levels of correlation across the stocks in the S&P. So there's a similarity in terms of the top heaviness with tech stocks now versus 99 and 2000, but what's very different is this low level of correlation. And I think managing correlation risk, I want to be a thread throughout this conversation because I think it's front and center with what you do, I would first like to just try to have you deliver us some of the terminology taxonomy. So I'm going to throw a couple terms out there. I wanted you to just talk through them. So of course, we have the single manager hedge fund, which is more and more difficult. The risk arb hedge fund, convert arb only, those are harder things to do these days. You have multi-strat, you have multi-manager, and then you have hodge shops. And I'm just wondering, the single manager thing, of course, you don't have to talk about, but those three, the multi-strat, multi-manager, and pod shop, perhaps you could just walk through where those are similar and where they can be distinguished.
Yeah. And so I guess if you take multi-strat can be a lot of different things. So most of the multi-managers, unless they are focused on one very specific segment, you could be a multi-manager business that focuses only on Japanese equities. That wouldn't necessarily be characterized as a multi-strat. But most of the multi-manager businesses tend to also fall into that world of multi-strat. But there are also multi-strat funds that are certainly not multi-manager. And so that would be a fund that makes top-down allocation decisions across different strategies based on the opportunity set, with effectively almost one CIO that is making those decisions and allocating capital and making a lot of changes. The multi-manager and the pod shop comparison are probably meshed together in the last few years. What's been really interesting is we're seeing this enormous secular change that's happening in the multi-manager / pod shop world over the last 5 or so years, which is that historically, the definition of pod shop or multi-manager tended to be a captive employee multi-strat multi-manager models, where you had a series of employee portfolio managers who were allocated sleeves of capital and then implemented their strategies as part of one broad firm. That's a business where it obviously has been an exceptional model. I think the root of it is it really took some of the best elements and removed some of the less attractive elements of both the sell side prop trading desk business, historically fund of hedge funds business, and put them together into what is effectively a prop desk that operates outside of the banks, but with some really distinct advantages around the way you can compensate people and the type of talent you can acquire and the type of things that you can do. And that, I think, is really the root of where this sort of multi-manager world came from. There's obviously some pioneers in this business who have done exceptional jobs over the years in developing the mousetrap and continuing to execute the mousetrap at a very high level. When you think about the model, the very simple definition of model is really just this notion of combining liquid, uncorrelated strategies with low pairwise correlations across the PMs into one model and then using some financial leverage to make the whole thing tick. And as I said, that was historically something that was happening most as employee, captive, multi-strat, multi-manager businesses. But this massive secular change that you're seeing is where some of these very, very large platforms have now become some of the largest hedge fund allocators in the world via separately managed accounts. And so you're also seeing in the marketplace, you're seeing a lot of formerly fund of funds businesses that used to make LP allocations across wide groups of hedge fund managers also transitioning their businesses into being separately managed account platforms. You're seeing a lot of sophisticated institutions, whether they be pension funds or, you know, sovereign wealth funds, out there building their own SMA platforms. And so you're really seeing this transition where there's a secular shift to where I think years ago, a lot of these platforms were really working very, very hard to keep all of the portfolio managers captive to the platform and really keeping them in-house. And now you've seen, essentially, you could almost describe it as they had their finger in the dam for many, many years, almost to keep everything on platform. And now you're seeing this massive secular shift where the dam is really broken. And some of these platforms, there are some large ones in particular, that have really become, I think in 2024, one of the largest hedge fund allocators on the planet was actually a multi-strat, multi-manager, a very large, very well-known multi-strat, multi-manager platform. That has some really significant implications for the way that sort of talent is moving in the business. I think some of them really positive for the industry and for underlying investors, and some of them not so positive for underlying investors. And so it's a time that is really exciting in that business, and someone who's obviously trying to build something that's delivering high quality returns for investors. For us, it's really important that we're innovating. It's really important that we have a really flexible mandate, that we have thoughtful ways of acquiring talent. So we really have to be a little bit different. And you have to do something a little bit different and sort of move with the market to be successful.
On the traditional pod shop model, what would you say are the very common overlapping characteristics? Fee pass-through would seem like one of them. And then where do they wind up differing in terms of their approach?
So I think the commonality across most of these platforms is, as I said in the beginning, so in terms of what they do, they're relatively similar. They're generally looking for liquid strategies that are uncorrelated. That generally, but not always, means low net. So in the equity space, it tends to mean low net. But so looking at uncorrelated strategies, some people will say high idio or uncorrelated or no beta or market neutral, but generally just looking for uncorrelated strategies. And then the third piece is just capital efficient. It is a business model that uses financial leverage. And so they're all generally looking for things that have an efficiency of capital, because the mousetrap is really taking things that are relatively low, unlevered volatility, packaging those uncorrelated strategies together with low average correlation, low average pairwise correlations, putting some financial leverage on that, and that turns it into effectively what is a much higher sharp return. I think that's common across all the platforms. Strategy-wise, what's also common across all the platforms that you would consider the sort of big multi-strats are that they do different flavors, but very similar buckets. So it's generally low net, fundamental, and systematic long-short equity investing. It's event and opportunistic investing. So think capital markets and syndicate, convert arb, merger arb, index arb, a lot of things that fall into that arbitrage RV space. A lot of systematic and discretionary macro investing that could be anything from fixed income relative value, futures-driven strategies in commodities or FX, and obviously rates and basis, bond basis, things like that. And then finally, a lot of them are doing things in the convexity space, which, you know, obviously convert arb falls into the convexity space, but also trading volatility as an asset class. All of these firms have that in common. What I think is different is that all these firms have a little bit of different flavors of the same business model. Almost all of them are, as you mentioned, pass-through fee structures, which effectively means that most of these firms don't charge investors a traditional management fee. Some do, but many of these firms don't charge investors a traditional management fee. And then they essentially take all the expenses of running the business, which is both the operating expenses of the parent or the centralized function of the multi-manager business. They take the costs of that and all the PM expenses and pass them through to investors, and then take an incentive fee at the end, assuming there's a positive net return. That's common across most of these firms. The model is expensive, but I think that the argument in favor of it would be that it probably has among the best alignment of interest with investors of any model out there in the world, because many of these models, when they don't charge a management fee, the only way that the GP of the business makes money is if investors generate a positive net return. So there's really strong alignment there. It's not an asset gathering, high margin fee business. That's common across them. Where they differ is either in the way that they structure the risk constraints or the specialization of either the model in terms of the way they engage with PMs or the asset classes that they're a little bit heavier on. So on the risk constraint side, I would say that each one of these firms picks a different spot on the spectrum between the risk constraints they place on PMs and the amount of leverage they use in their model. So some of these firms choose really, really tight risk constraints on the PMs, and then they use more leverage. And other firms obviously provide a little bit more flexibility, then they use a little bit less leverage. There's not a right answer. There are firms that have been successful and not successful using both models. I don't think there's a correct way to do it. There are some firms that have frankly been exceptional at both models, but they choose those different constraints. In our business, we tend to be a little bit more bespoke when we think about risk model and risk analytics with portfolio managers. And what I mean by that is that not all PMs are created the same. A market neutral long short equity strategy could be 3% unlevered vol, or it could be 11% unlevered vol. It could be doing spec pharma and biotech. It could be doing utilities or large cap pharma or things like that. And so for us, we tend to be a little bit more bespoke around how we think about risk constraints. And then we just address that through sizing, meaning that we can tolerate a manager that needs wider drawdown provisions and wider risk constraints. We're just going to probably size a little bit smaller so we have the right vol budget or risk contribution of that portfolio. So I think that's what's a little bit different about each of these firms. And then the other differences really are around strategies. There are some firms that tend to be a little bit heavier in the fixed income RV space. There are some firms that tend to be a little bit heavier in the long short equity space. And then the last thing, which I think really equates to the secular change that we're seeing in the business, is that structurally, there also tend to be some pretty significant differences in these firms in how they engage with portfolio managers. And what I mean by that is that some firms will be exclusively an employee model. So almost all of their portfolio managers are employees of the firm. They're effectively, all those PMs are effectively running single investor capital for the firm that they work for. They have access to resources and analytics and all the great things about working at a firm, but the portfolio manager has a little bit less stability. They effectively run money for one investor. There are other firms out there, and I think we would more fall into this bucket, where you have a much more flexible mandate in terms of the way that you engage with portfolio manager talent. And that can be anything from hiring them to be employees, just like at some of those employee-focused firms. It can be third-party separately managed accounts. It can be giving them an infrastructure offering and running their business and letting them focus only on investing. So it's really about, how are you going to acquire talent? What's your edge? And how are you going to compete in the market for talent? Because there's obviously a lot of demand out there. There's an enormous amount of information in the press about all the big buyouts and things like that for portfolio managers. And then there's also a lot of allocators out there today that are allocating SMA capital. So you really have to have an innovative and thoughtful value proposition for portfolio managers if you want to acquire really high quality talent.
So you've described this evolution from multi-manager 1.0 to 2.0, talked about some of the larger pod shops actually being allocators themselves to outside capital. Perhaps your efforts at Folger were a little bit more in the 1.0 category. So as you think about Fortress and the 2.0 version of the multi-manager group and your specific approach, so perhaps start with the structure part of it. You've talked about having employees, but also these SMAs. Maybe dive into that a little bit more. Talk about what the advantages are from your perspective.
Sure. Yeah, it's good that you bring up Folger Hill. And I think that was something that I was part of the team that went out and really tried to go out and build a business that was effectively going to compete head on in the employee multi-strat, multi-manager model with some of the biggest, most successful players in the business. And I could talk for hours about the experience. And I think it ultimately was something that was not successful, right? Certainly our US business was not successful. We built a pretty high quality Asia business, but the US business was not successful. And some of the reasons why it was not successful were structural. Some of the reasons were self-inflicted. I sometimes say that it was kind of both the best and the worst thing that I've done in my professional career. It was the first time I had done something that I would characterize as not having been a professional success. That for me, I think, turned out to be probably the most transformational thing that I went through, because number one, it gave me an opportunity clearly to experience some adversity. We can maybe talk about this when we talk about an organization and how we think about looking for people and things like that. I think experiencing adversity and how you deal with adversity and overcome adversity is one of the most important character traits of anyone, probably in life and in your profession. But it also really gave me a roadmap to the business that we're building today at Fortress in really understanding the depth of this model, why these businesses are so difficult to build, why so many firms have had a hard time reaching escape velocity, and really what we can do at Fortress to really go out and have a value proposition in the business that addresses all of those issues that, number one, make it really difficult to start these businesses. And number two, some of the reasons why some investors either don't like or are a little bit more wary of the multi-strat, multi-manager models. That really gave me this great experience and this great roadmap to build what we're doing today. And in our business today at Fortress, part of the reason why I was so excited to do the deal with Fortress is because I'd started building this business in late 2021 with a small team of folks. We spent about 2 years building out the business initially as an external multi-strat, multi-manager model. And so what that effectively meant is that I decided, okay, as I build this business, I don't want to go out and compete head-on with some of the biggest, highest-scaled, well-known blue-chip firms. But I recognized, which years ago, this was novel. Today, it's less novel. I realized that there was a really good opportunity out there to allocate SMA capital to really high-quality portfolio managers that, generally speaking, were former platform or prop desk or something simpler PMs who had their own businesses, had strong track records, you had an enormous amount of data, you could do tons of quantitative analysis on them, you could get attractive terms, you could give them an SMA, and you could give smaller allocations than if you were trying to compete head on with some of the big folks to hire PMs. spent about 2 years building out the business, bringing on PMs, letting go PMs, getting the risk engine right, getting the financing engine right, really trying to reach escape velocity, which many, many folks who are experts in this industry will tell you, it takes a long time. It takes easily 2 to 3 or even 4 years to really build these businesses and reach escape velocity. And so about 2 years in, I was very fortunate in that I engaged with Fortress. It was the right time for us. It was the right time for Fortress. And I had this vision where, as part of an organization like Fortress, particularly with the support of the leadership there and folks like Drew McKnight, who's co-CEO of Fortress, I really thought that as part of Fortress, we had the opportunity to take this thing that we were just reaching escape velocity and just starting to really get it right and turn it into something world-class.
Well, we started this conversation with some of your background in Vol and talked about this low correlation in the S&P. And that's really the holy grail for firms like yours, is to deliver an uncorrelated, consistently uncorrelated return stream. And so from a high level, I'd love to have you summarize how you think about that. Talent acquisition and finding people is the right thing, but also you've got to really think through the strategies themselves, how they interact in different stress events. So high level, walk us through how you think about the diversification and correlation components of what you do.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the business comes down to three things, right? It's talent acquisition, it's risk management, and it's financing. That is the model. And the risk management piece for me, it does go way back to the beginning, which is that I started my career as a vol trader. So when you think about running a multi-strat, multi-manager business, you spend an enormous amount of time thinking about really manager and portfolio volatility, and then the correlation across those managers and also relative to different things in the market. What was great for me in starting my career as a vol trader is, when you think about what does a vol trader do? The vol trader really focuses on volatility and correlation. And then you think about what is risk management, and risk management, among other things, and liquidity and factor analysis and stuff like that. But ultimately, risk management is also volatility and correlation, or standard deviation and correlation. And so I think it was a really fantastic transition to move from having a vol background to then being a risk manager at large multi-billion dollar funds that were both just equities and then multi-asset, to then ultimately running a multi-strat, multi-manager business, because it's really all the same principles and it's a natural evolution. For us, when we really think about things and we think about building all of this, putting all of this together, what we're mainly focused on is, what are the underlying unlevered volatilities of each of our portfolio managers? And then how do all of those uncorrelated strategies work together? And a lot of this is really recognizing also, and this again, I think it goes back to one of the basic fundamental understandings of both the options market and risk management, which is that you have to understand their shortcomings. The obvious, very basic shortcoming of traditional risk analytics is that you're using historical data to predict the future. So when you calculate VAR, and you can absolutely do things to combat that, you can exponentially weight the more recent data points and do a lot of different analysis. You can stress different elements of correlation and vol. But at the end of the day, traditional risk analytics give you analysis that tells you what the world looks like if the future looks like the past. In our model, in running a multi-strat, multi-manager model, there's sort of basic math that you can look at in that construct, which is that you say, okay, this is our portfolio volatility. This is the VAR of our portfolio. These are the pairwise correlations across our managers. And if you notice that you have particularly liens or things in the portfolio, whether it be a factor lien or a market lien, or your VAR changes or your underlying elements of that change, mathematically, there are ways you can address it, right? Okay, our momentum exposure gets to this level. That level is uncomfortable for us. There are things that we can do to take that exposure down. And there's a variety of tools for that. The really much more relevant part of risk management in this model is understanding that when you really have problems, it's when those historical relationships break down, when future volatility doesn't look like historical volatility, or when historical correlations are not a good indicator of what future correlations look like. And this goes way back to the same principles of when you're a vol trader. There's historical vol, realized volatility. There's implied volatility, which is the market's prediction for future volatility. And then there's historical implied volatility, which is the historical predicted volatility. And I think really understanding that and how all those things work together is critical in the multi-strat, multi-manager model. And I often talk to folks, sometimes we talk about things like beta. And I think beta is one of the most obvious examples where it can be, it has the potential to be one of the most dangerous metrics that you look at as a risk manager. Because if you think about beta in the most basic sense of the calculation, you're looking at the historical volatility of an asset divided by the historical volatility of a market times correlation, right? You can have assets that are extraordinarily volatile, but are just historically uncorrelated to the market and therefore have a low beta. So when you have a correlation event in the market, beta is a terrible predictive indicator of what's going to happen. A best example would be, think about like a biotech stock that's moving towards an event. That biotech stock might flatline or be very uncorrelated to the market on the way to an event. But if that biotech stock has four times the volatility of the market, if you have a correlation event in the market and the market dislocates, that stock's going to move much more like its vol than it does like its historical beta. So for us, an enormous part of risk management for us is really recognizing and understanding and trying to predict how well is our portfolio protected when those historical relationships break down. You oftentimes, in long-short equity is a great example, oftentimes you have portfolio managers who are running fundamental long-short equity portfolios. They tend to effectively be short correlation inherently in a lot of ways. And what that means is you might have a collection of really strong alpha ideas on the long side. You may not have as many really good alpha ideas on the short side. And so a lot of folks will end up having short positions, oftentimes core short positions, in some industry names that tend to be mega caps that are low vol. So your healthcare portfolio manager might be short Pfizer and Merck and some big names like that. Your energy PM might be short Chevron and some of the large cap names like that. And then what happens is when the market dislocates, all these more mid-cap names that you have dislocate. You really have to spend a lot of time. You know, you can address that through obviously being really aware of your factor risk, being really aware if you're making bets on size or volatility or different things like that, or what your idio is. But for us at a portfolio level, it's critical that we're looking at the portfolio and saying, okay, if we have a correlation event, if we have a liquidation event, what is going to be wrong with traditional risk analytics and the way that they analyze our portfolio? And what are the things that we can do to combat that? And as silly as it sounds, some of that gets away from the more traditionally academic principles of risk management. And some of it is a little bit more common sense and really spending time diving in and looking. And so it's looking at things like quintiling of different valuation buckets. We do something which is pretty basic, but makes sense on all of our portfolio managers, which is we do a worst days analysis. We have the benefit of obviously having an enormous data set on all of our portfolio managers. And so I may look at what are the 10 or 15 worst days that this portfolio manager has had in their entire data set? And then we compare it and say, what was happening in the world when those days occurred? Were the equity markets down? Did oil do something? Did rates do something? Were particular factors moving? What happened to our portfolio? Was it a big hedge fund unwind day where crowding as a factor did poorly? And really just assessing how much commonality do we have in our portfolio when historical relationships break down?
Let's finish out with some of your thoughts and approach on the human capital side of things. It's an incredibly competitive environment for risk takers. You've hired a lot of them along the way. I'm sure you've interviewed multiples and multiples of the number you've hired. So you've gotten a great look over the many years you've been doing this. Just talk to us about perhaps the traits and qualities that you look for. I'm sure those are associated with what you found as ingredients to success. Walk us through your approach.
Yeah. So there's two pieces to it. There's probably structure and there's people. And structure, we try to be really flexible in our mandate. Again, it goes back to that multi-manager 1.0 to 2.0, the massive secular change that's occurring. And so the first thing we want to do is set our business up. If there is good talent in the market, we have a place for it. That means if a portfolio manager engages with us, we have a really flexible way that we can engage with them. It could be as an employee PM, it could be a third-party SMA, or it could even be an infrastructure solution, which is effectively like a hedge fund in a box. And this is, I think, a unique, sort of unique thing and sort of interesting is like all these managers that are spinning off and leaving platforms and starting their own businesses, one of the things I think that allocators have to ask themselves is if you really like a portfolio manager as an investor, do you like them as much when they have to spend a third of their time, 40% of the time, I don't know what the number is, managing a business, doing things away from investing? One of the things that we offer is an infrastructure solution where we can set up a portfolio manager and effectively do everything for them. Set up their LLC, do ops, accounting, legal, all the space, like all the infrastructure things for them while they build their business. And we choose to take that approach, sometimes exclusive, sometimes non-exclusive. And I think for us, it makes us comfortable because we know we have scale to manage the operational infrastructure and we can let the portfolio manager focus only on investing. It's having this really flexible mandate where we can engage with really good talent. And then the other thing is on people. I mean, there are different approaches for each one of those different solutions. The nice part about generally the SMA world or the third-party allocation world is you tend to have a lot more data. Is that a lot of these portfolio managers, you have daily returns, you have portfolio snapshots, you have a lot of data that you could analyze on these portfolio managers. In the employee world, if you're hiring someone from someplace, it tends to be a little bit more mosaic theory, where you're putting together pieces to try and figure out if you think this portfolio manager is going to generate high quality returns for you in the future. I think you have to be both very quantitative and also very qualitative. And so we're one of the firms out there that we don't have a sourcing function and an evaluation function. We have a team that really does that together. They're going all over the world to turn over rocks and find investment talent wherever they can that meets our very simple criteria. Got to be liquid, got to be uncorrelated, got to be capital efficient. And then we're doing very, very extensive, both quantitative and qualitative analysis to determine whether or not we want to allocate capital to that person. In terms of the personal traits, I mean, it's debatable, but I tend to love people that have something to prove. Talked about adversity before, right? Going through a drawdown for a portfolio manager, it's a really difficult experience. It's difficult financially. It's difficult emotionally, especially if they've never done it before. And we have a phrase that we sometimes say, which is that if you don't have a significant drawdown in your past, it's in your future. I'm definitely not someone that says, oh, this person had a big drawdown at one period in their career, so they're off limits to us. What did you learn from that? How did you behave during that? What lessons have you learned and how have you changed your process since then? So you'll be prepared the next time that that happens. And so for us, I think adversity is really important. I'm a little bit more flexible on where they came from or where they went to school or things like that. It goes for both portfolio managers and people that work on our team, helping us run the business. Table stakes for me is I just want to find somebody that cares as much as I do. And I want to find somebody that is just going to be relentless in their pursuit for excellence. We talk all this stuff about building a business. At the end of the day, excellence is defined by one thing. It's, do you do a good job of generating a high quality return for your investors? And that's it. That's why we're here. We're not here for any other reason. All the other good things that come from this business come if you do that. If you don't do that, nothing else matters. What we're looking for are just people that care as much as we do. I have folks on our team that I absolutely love because I find myself having to be very careful to let them know if I ask them to do something, then I have to let them know when I want it done. Because if I think of something on a Friday at 5 p.m. and say, hey, could you do this for me? They'll send it back at 11 p.m. on Friday night. And so I almost have to be careful to say, hey, just, you know, like it's the next week item. Don't worry about it. That's what we want. Those are the kind of people that they just care and they're relentless and they want to make this work as much as I do and deliver something really high quality to investors. And so all that stuff has to work together for us to be successful.
Well, we covered a lot of ground in this conversation. We had a little bit of vol and correlation and some market lessons, but also really the structure of the business and specifically how you think about the multi-manager business. So Todd, I've really appreciated the conversation. It was great to have you as a guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it and look forward to a future conversation.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again and catch you next time.